Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. A Davenport man has been charged in a 2022 fatal shooting in Cedar Falls that claimed the life of a Clear Lake resident. Bo Bradley Ekstrom, 31, is charged with first-degree murder, felon in possession of a firearm, and intimidation with a weapon. He was transferred to the Blackhawk County Jail on Monday after he was released from prison on unrelated charges. Authorities allege Ekstrom was one of the people involved in the February 6, 2022 shooting on College Street that resulted in the death of 19-year-old Arthur Craig Lang of Clear Lake. Prosecutors described that incident as a chance encounter between two groups that didn't know each other and erupted in gunfight around closing time in the College Hill area. According to court records, Ekstrom and a friend were standing in the area of the G parking lot in the 2200 block of College Street around 1:45 a.m. A SUV containing Lang and others from the Mason City Clear Lake area pulled up to the two. Holt began talking to people in the vehicle, and at some point, shooting broke out with Ekstrom firing at people in the vehicle. Lang was hit and driven to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Holt was also injured by gunfire and suffered a partially severed spine, according to police. Ekstrom fled and hid his handgun, which investigators later found, records state. They also found 7 spent shell casings where he had been standing during the shooting. One of the people from the vehicle, Brandon Javon Mitchell, was arrested for attempted murder, intimidation with a weapon, and prohibited person in possession of a firearm. His trial is tentatively set for July. Another, Daniel Martiz Judon IV, pleaded to intimidation with a weapon and was sentenced to up to 10 years in prison. Court records show Ekstrom has prior convictions in Scott County for lascivious acts with a child, failure to register as a sex offender, and criminal mischief for damaging his GPS monitoring device. Authorities are investigating a Tuesday afternoon semi-tractor trailer crash that sent people to the hospital. Details weren't immediately available, but initial reports indicate a half dozen vehicles were involved in the collision at the intersection of Washington Street and Hawthorne Avenue. A semi involved in the accident came to rest on the sidewalk in front of the Dollar Tree discount store. A sign was toppled over and landed crumpled in the parking lot. Waterloo police and firefighters responded to the scene. One person was arrested on drug and weapons charges after running from a traffic stop in January. Police Saturday arrested Octavio Perez Perez, 22, of 114 Butler Avenue, for possession of meth with intent to deliver, violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act, carrying weapons, interference, and possession of marijuana. According to court records, police stopped a GMC Canyon for an obscured license plate in the area of West 4th and Wellington Streets around 11:05 p.m. January 25th. The driver, identified as Perez, fled on foot, and officers found a 9mm high-point handgun in the vehicle. On Saturday, officers spotted Perez in the area of Block Street and Butler Avenue around 9:10 p.m. He was detained following a brief scuffle, and authorities found bags of meth and marijuana in his pockets, according to court records. One person was injured in an apparent firearm accident Tuesday night. Details weren't available, but a 19-year-old male arrived at the Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center with a gunshot wound to his shin around 7:54 p.m., according to police. Police said the injuries don't appear to be life-threatening. It wasn't clear where the shooting happened. A Mason City man died after colliding with a deer on his motorcycle early Sunday morning. A Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's Deputy located the crash near the 1300 block of Broad Street in Plymouth just before 4:30 a.m. March 31st. Law enforcement identified Alan Schaefer, 22, as the operator of the motorcycle. According to a sheriff's report, Schaefer was traveling northbound on Broad Street when he struck a deer that entered the roadway. Paramedics were on the scene where Schaefer was pronounced deceased. The Mason City Police Department, Mason City Fire Department, and the Plymouth Fire Department assisted on the scene. The role of Waterloo's downtown U.S. Postal Service building may change as part of the organization's strategy to upgrade its mailing networks. The building at 300 Sycamore Street currently processes and dispatches mail collected at post offices and collection boxes in a broad geographic area. A review by the USPS recommends converting the facility to a local processing center. Such facilities are the middleman between regional processing and distribution centers and sorting and delivering centers. Sorting and delivery centers will aggregate mail for processing at larger, centrally located sites for delivery to a larger geographic area. The study comes as part of the Postal Service investing $40 billion into analyzing the country's processing, transportation, and delivery networks. The agency plans to spend $6 to $8 million to update and modernize the Waterloo facility. The study evaluated whether efficiency could be increased by transferring mail processing operations to Des Moines, redesigning mail processing operations, or expanding operations. Press releases state that moving services to Des Moines will not result in this facility's closure or career employee layoffs. But later in the press release, it states the transfer of outgoing operations there is an estimated net decrease of 11 craft and no management positions are projected. USPS representatives did not respond to emails or phone calls with questions about potential layoffs. The release also states all bargaining employee reassignments will be made in accordance with bargaining agreements. Throughout the review, delivery services will not be affected. Business mail entry, post office, station, and branch retail services are not expected to change. If the facility's function switches, it will be fitted with new mail sorting and processing equipment. Things such as lighting, flooring, space flow, dock areas, and employee amenity areas would also be upgraded. With these upgrades, the proposed cost savings in Waterloo are $860,000 to $1.1 million. Reviews across the country are part of Postal Service's 10-year strategic plan to break even financially by 2031. The organization's revenues haven't covered its expenses and debts for more than 15 years. Residents can submit written comments to USPS until April 10th at surveymonkey.com/r/mpfr-waterloo-ia. Supporters of a jailed social content creator filled the Waterloo Cedar Council chambers with their phone cameras and tripods Monday night. A handful of men, part of a group called Butt Crack News Network, spoke to the City Council about the sentencing of Bo Bish. Bish is completing a 10-day jail sentence for interfering with the Waterloo Police Department. In April 2022, Bish was recording the arrest of his neighbor as video evidence on his YouTube channel, Flex Your Freedoms, which has nearly 80,000 subscribers. He regularly recorded public officials and police departments, something called First Amendment auditing. During his neighbor's arrest, Waterloo police officers told Bish to stand back and physically moved him back from the scene onto the street to establish a safety buffer. Bish was standing on the sidewalk outside of the property where the arrest took place. After these confrontations started, Bish yelled profanities at the officers, who directed him to move. After Sergeant Greg Erie became involved, Bish told Erie to perform a sexual act on him and called him a tyrant. One Bish supporter defended those actions, saying, "Talking back to law enforcement is his right." The men who spoke on Bish's behalf did not identify themselves to the council or the courier, citing their Fourth Amendment rights. "Your officer admitted my feelings were hurt when you called me a tyrant," one man said. "You know what that is? When your feelings are hurt when you're called a tyrant, that's tyranny." During closing arguments at Bish's trial last year, a county attorney said Bish's actions took away officers' attention from performing an arrest and search. The members of Butt Crack News Network didn't just come to denounce the police department. They also criticized Ward 1 council member John Childs, who was on the jury for Bish's trial. Childs was not present, but joined the meeting after the public comment portion. Childs previously stated he did not want to be on the jury due to his counsel position and close relationships to the police department. The defense could have removed Childs during jury selection, but chose not to. After the trial, Bish posted Childs' phone number and email address, which was public due to his position as an elected official, to his followers. Childs said Bish's followers threatened him. After Bish's supporters entered council chambers, a man live-streaming the meeting noted to viewers many times that Childs was not present. On X, formerly known as Twitter, the group noted that Bish is a combat veteran. The post said Bish's jail time was unjust and likened him to Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. It also said after Bish is out of jail, he will be back in full force. "The reason why people do what we do is because the public attitude is that we're doing it for attention," another man said about recording officials and law enforcement after the council meeting. "It's good to normalize it because it's a right." In other business, the council approved a development and assessment agreement with River Plaza Investments, LLC, for the renovation of the building at 10 West 4th Street into a 56-unit apartment building. The former YMCA would need to have a minimum assessed value of $6.7 million after renovations under the agreement. The company will receive $5,000 of infill incentives for each unit, as well as rebates of 50% for 10 years. The Cedar Falls City Council searched for ways on Monday to save taxpayers money in its proposed fiscal year 2025 budget. The preliminary ideas will make little difference, but the city already has one of the leaner budgets in the state amongst larger municipalities. The council spent 90 minutes discussing five changes it hoped could reduce property taxes, supporting an approximately $98 million budget, or $114 million if certain transfers are included. Only two of the changes, however, will be part of the proposed budget presented to the council for a possible vote on April 15th. The budget must be passed by April 30th and takes effect July 1st. Proposed tax collections sat at $25.99 million to begin the night, but would now be closer to $25.8 million. The current year budget sits at $23.78 million. Finance and Business Operations Director Jennifer Roddenbeck attributed the rise to regular salary increases, health insurance contributions, and new positions, as personnel costs are a bulk of the operating budget. The two changes receiving majority support were a $50,000 reduction to a rarely used program offering financial assistance to convert rental properties to single-family homes, and a reduction of $100,000 in general fund savings for capital projects. The measures advanced in separate 4-3 votes. Council members Hannah Chrisman and Kelly Dunn dissented both times, joined by Chris Latta on the former and Aaron Haubacker on the latter. Three other proposals failed to pass. Two involved cutting new positions. A new aquatics supervisor is viewed as a one-time cost for 1 year of succession planning, overlapping as current supervisor Chris Shontag prepares to retire in May of next year, according to the Recreation Division. The position, managing and maintenance at the falls, is largely seasonal. The motion to remove it failed 4-3, with council members Daryl Cruz, Dustin Ganfield, and Aaron Haubacker in support. The second position is a new policy specialist for tasks ranging from landing Department of Transportation grants to studying conflicts of interests and other special projects, said Ron Beck. That motion to remove also failed 5-2. Cruz and Ganfield supported it. Both cost around $100,000 each for salary and benefits. No objections were voiced to hiring a second school resource officer. Some of that cost, more than $100,000, would be shared with the school district. The other proposal involved budgeting $100,000 more for hotel-motel tax revenue. However, city attorney Kevin Rogers poured cold water on the potential for savings because voters approved how revenue can be used. The motion failed 5-2, Cruz and Ganfield in support. The property tax rate at $11.93 per $1,000 evaluation to begin the night, the proposed changes would drop it to approximately $11.86. Currently, the rate is $11.40, which the city says is seventh lowest among Iowa's 20 largest cities, fourth per capita. After factoring in an average property tax valuation increase of 20% and a residential property rollback drop from 54.65% to 46.34%, a homeowner's bill would increase an estimated 6% if the proposed changes are enacted. That was closer to 6.5% before the proposed changes won preliminary consent. No one spoke from the public during the first two hearings that are part of the budget process under the newly enacted House File 718. A mile-long stretch of West Viking Road is one step closer to being reconstructed. The City Council unanimously voted to approve the plans for the work, estimated at $7.82 million, on the outskirts of the industrial park. Matt Tolan, one of the city's lead civil engineers, said afterwards that council members should expect to consider construction bids at its May 6th meeting. Workers are slated to reconstruct the road from Production Drive to Union Road, extend Innovation Drive to Viking Road, and construct a single-lane roundabout at that future intersection, Tolan told the council. He also said the project includes recreational trails from Hudson Road to Innovation Drive and around the Northern Industrial Park Pond, new and replacement curb and gutter from Production Drive to Hudson Road, an extension of sanitary sewer and water main, and other improvements at the Hudson Road intersection. If bids are awarded on schedule and all goes forward as planned, Tolan said during an interview that work could begin as soon as this June and would continue through at least two construction seasons. The bulk of the projects is expected to be completed by Thanksgiving 2025, but minor work would take place that following spring 2026. City engineer Dave Wick said by phone that the work is in part facilitating future growth at the industrial park, but is not necessarily the sole reason why. The council included the reconstruction project among the 217 undertakings in the capital improvements program it adopted in January. Council members also approved an agreement with Snyder and Associates Incorporated for design services on an hourly basis, costing no more than $81,400. Additionally, they agreed to acquire several permanent and temporary easements from 17 properties, compensating those owners anywhere from a few hundred to several thousand dollars. Council member Dustin Ganfield offered up the lone comment before the vote, one of gratitude for the engineers on the project. West Cedar Elementary School in Waverly is one step closer to being barred from private school usage and turned into housing for people who are disadvantaged. The City Council voted 6-0 on Monday on behalf of the Waverly Low Rent Housing Agency and Housing Commission to purchase the 3.43 acres at 221 15th Street Northwest for $5,000 from the Waverly Shell Rock School District. The council's approval also included a stipulation reflecting a deed restriction that disallows the public school building from being used as a competing private or charter school. There was no substantive debate on the purchase for low-income rental housing aimed at people who are elderly or disabled. Council member Rodney Drenko was absent. The agreement states that closing will occur on a date mutually agreed upon by the parties before June 30th. The Board of Education approved the sale in February after rejecting a significantly higher bid of $70,000 from Inspired Life. Its hope had been to turn it into a private school in partnership with Waterloo Christian School. The property is viewed as an ideal location for the cost-effective expansion of the nearby 155 units at Waverly Homes and Waverly Manor at 320 15th Street Northwest and Red Cedar Place, 426 16th Street Northwest, according to council meeting documents. The Low Rent Housing Agency manages two federally subsidized apartment complexes for the elderly under the direction of the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Waverly Housing Commission, its website states. Officials made clear Monday that the purchase is paid for through the agency and commission's budget, not the city. The building became available after voters approved a referendum in 2021 to construct two new elementary schools to replace three current schools. West Cedar students are moving at the end of this school year. Meeting documents state that a consultant has been brought on board to investigate possible redevelopment for housing there. Documents do not make clear whether a decision has been made on whether to convert the current school building to housing or raze it and start over. If the commission keeps the current school building, the Courier previously reported that 10 to 15 units could be created. A figure wasn't immediately available for how much housing could fit within the confines of the property if the school were torn down. Marcy McNeil has been named the new CEO of New Aldea Lifescapes. She will succeed Melissa Tierney, who announced her retirement last year after more than 31 years. McNeil previously served as administrator for Sunrise Hill Care and Rehab Center, a for-profit continuing care retirement community in Traer, according to a press release, At Sunrise Hill, she managed all day-to-day operations, financial review, staff and resident satisfaction, strategic planning, forecasting, and budgeting. In addition, she headed the execution of COVID-19 policies and acquired deficiency-free control surveys from 2021 to 2023. The 2021 survey was the first such survey achieved in 16 years. During her time at Sunrise, she achieved a Bronze Commitment to Quality Award from the American Healthcare Association. McNeil also was instrumental in eliminating agency staffing usage by leading recruitment efforts for new staff members, along with creative staffing implementation. She increased census by 22% and oversaw the complete development of the company's budget. She received McKnight's Rising Star Award in 2021. McNeil previously served as an interim executive director and consultant for Live Long and Prosper, a self-owned business. She is former administrator of record at Winterset Care Center North in Winterset. She also served on several AHCA committees and was named to AHCA's Quality Award Program as a Silver Level Examiner. New Aldea will hold a welcome ceremony from 4 to 5:30 p.m. on April 18th at Elms Pub at New Aldea Lifescapes. Tree clearing has begun in preparation for construction on the new interchange and frontage roads at U.S. Highway 218th and 260th Street near Janesville. But highway travel south of Waverly and north of Janesville won't be affected this year. The work that's going to take place this year will have very little to no impact on traffic, said Pete Helmstad, Field Services Coordinator with the Iowa Department of Transportation. We will have here and there some very intermittent lane closures. Work will begin in the next few weeks that will eventually help funnel vehicles into a new $36 million diamond interchange on U.S. 218. That 2024 work by Peterson Contractors Incorporated will include grading and dirt work and construction of the bridges off to the west of 218, where the highway eventually will be relocated to bring traffic over 260th Street. The new North Maple Street will be connected to the current road in Janesville. That new roadway will eventually extend along the west side of the highway and along the railroad tracks up to 260th Street. Maple Street will be closed off from access to Highway 218 that will eventually be the same fate for the other crossroads with access to the highway: Edgebrook Drive, Cedar Drive, Island View Drive, Eagle Avenue, and 250th Street. The new interchange became a priority as a result of growth in traffic and the traffic projected to increase from 24,350 in 2025 to 32,420 in 2045. The next two construction seasons will have more impact on the highway travel. All traffic will be head-to-head beginning in spring 2025 as it's all shifted to the northbound lanes and new southbound lanes are constructed. In spring of 2026, all traffic will be head-to-head in the southbound lanes as the northbound lanes are built. The new interchange should be completed by fall of 2026. The project includes two new roundabouts on 260th Street to the west and east sides of the relocated Highway 218. The new frontage roads will include extensions and reconfigurations of 250th Street and Easton and Eagle Avenues, as well as Maple Road, giving people from all directions access to 260th Street and Highway 218. You are listening to the Reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, April 4th, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Luella J. Van Wy, 89, passed away peacefully at her home in Johnston on March 29th. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. on Friday, April 5th at Isles Westover Chapel, Hickman Road in Des Moines. A service will follow beginning at 11 a.m. Interment will be 3 p.m. Friday at the East Friesland Cemetery in rural Ackley. Luella was born on July 15, 1934, in Ackley. She met Leslie Van Wy on a blind date, June 8, 1953, and on June 8, 1954, they were married. They made their home in Waterloo. They hosted foreign exchange students from France and Black Hawk hockey players. Luella was a dental assistant, skilled seamstress, loved travel, camping, and playing cards with her friends and family. She was a member of the Westminster Presbyterian Church and a Girl Scout leader in Waterloo. She worked at Sears in Waterloo in the men's department for several years before retiring in 1996. In 2007, she moved to Johnston. Memorial contributions may be directed to Ellipsis in Johnston. Ronald Mangrich, 80, of LaPorte City, died in his home on Tuesday, April 2nd. He was born February 21, 1944, in Waterloo. Ron graduated from Don Bosco High School. He then graduated from Omaha Technical Trade School. He married Peggy Frost on August 1, 1964, at the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville. Ron worked at John Deere for over 30 years in the foundry until he retired in 1993. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 6th, at the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville. Burial will be in St. Mary's Cemetery in Gilbertville. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 5th, with a 6:30 p.m. prayer service at Lock on 4th. Memorials may be directed to the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church and St. Jude's Hospital. Phyllis Ann Cooper passed away April 1st at Friendship Village, Wellspring. She was born September 13, 1927. At 16, she graduated summa cum laude from Our Lady of Victory Academy. After attending Clark College, she went to work in the classifieds department at the Waterloo Daily Courier. She met the love of her life, Francis Cooper, and after a whirlwind courtship, they were wed on September 16, 1950 at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Frank's advertising work led to many moves for the young family, to St. Joseph, Missouri, to Des Moines, and back to Cedar Falls and Waterloo. While raising four children, Phyllis became involved in her community as a member of Junior League. She volunteered many hours at the Bargain Shop in Waterloo. She was a member of PEO and participated in many bridge clubs and book groups. She was a 60-plus year member of St. Edward's Church and supported the Sierra Club. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Kenneth Laverne Lorraine, 90, of Waverly, passed away March 31st. Born on January 16, 1934, he served in the U.S. Marines and later worked at Nestle Company for 40 years. He was a member of St. Paul Lutheran Church and school. He was an avid golfer and enjoyed umpiring softball. Jerry Lee Leslie, 85, formerly of Omaha, Nebraska, passed away on March 22nd in Spring Hill, Kansas. Jerry was born March 24th in Waterloo. He married Patricia Jenness in 1959 and after several moves settled in Omaha, where they founded, owned, and operated Leslie Structural Sales, LLC, for 45-plus years. A memorial, He had a passion for music and was a charter member and the founding director of the Pathfinder Barbershop Chorus in Fremont, Nebraska. As a faithful member of the St. Paul United Methodist Church in Omaha, he continued worshiping weekly online while living in Kansas. A memorial service and celebration of life is being held Saturday, April 6th at 11 a.m. at St. Paul Benson in Omaha, Nebraska, with a private family service of interment to be set at a later date. Janet R. Andrews, 75, of Independence, died Sunday, March 31st at her home in Independence following a courageous battle with cancer. Celebration of life will be 11 a.m. Thursday, April 4th at the Hope Wesleyan Church in Independence, followed by a light lunch to continue the celebration of life at Denali's in Independence. Burial will be at a later date. Memorial visitation will be from 9 a.m. until services Thursday at the church. Hildegard C. Larson, 98, of Waterloo, entered into eternal rest on March 19th. Following Hildegard's wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. Public visitation will be held on Friday, April 5th, from 9 to 10 a.m. at First Congregational Church in Waterloo. A celebration of Hildegard's life will begin at 10 a.m. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to Hildegard's name to either the Cedar Valley Hospice Home or Friendship Village. To leave an online condolence that will also be viewed by her family in Germany, please visit HagertyWyckoffGarupGroup.com. And in some local sports news, longtime Wartburg College men's basketball coach Dick Peff announced his retirement Tuesday after 27 years as the Knights' head coach. Peff is the second longest tenured coach in program history and was the longest serving current coach in the athletics department. A member of two Hall of Fames, Peff owns a career record of 622 wins and 425 losses, which includes a record of 401 to 302 since coming to Wartburg in 1997 for 27 seasons. He earned his 400th victory at Wartburg this past season and surpassed the 600 career win mark in 2021. Peff led the Knights to back-to-back Iowa Conference titles in 2004-2005 and 2005-2006, and was the Division II AC Coach of the Year in 2001 and 2005. Before coming to Wartburg, Peff spent 12 seasons at the University of Denver as head coach, where he won more than 220 games. Peff played collegiately for the University of Iowa and Lute Olson and was team captain for the 1979 team that won the Big Ten Conference title. In college softball, UNI falls to Iowa State. Solo home runs by Darren Lamprecht and Alexis Papilio were not enough as Northern Iowa dropped an 8-3 decision to Iowa State Tuesday in a non-conference softball game. The Panthers left the bases loaded in the first with a chance to build some momentum, and four defensive errors sunk UNI. Lamprecht homered in the third, and two batters later, Papilio hammered her 12th of the season to pull the Panthers within 3-2. But the Cyclones scored three times in the bottom of the inning to take control. UNI opens a three-game Missouri Valley Conference home series against Missouri State Friday at 5 p.m. In high school soccer, the West boys improve to 2-0. Isaac Kelba and Adnan Dedek each scored twice, and Bo T. had three assists as Waterloo West topped Cedar Rapids Jefferson 5-1 Tuesday at Memorial Stadium. The Wahawks, 2-0, scored all five of their goals in the second half. Aiden Bajramovic also scored for West. The Wahawk girls dropped a 4-3 decision to Jefferson in Cedar Rapids. And on to more local news. Black Hawk County has unveiled a new logo. The project has been in the works for the past year and took off once Gabby DeWitt, the marketing director, was hired in January. Until Tuesday, the logo was in the shape of the county with a bird flying over it. The image has been in use for a decade. DeWitt presented the logo to the Board of Supervisors Tuesday. It consists of the lowercase letters BHC with a design in the B's circular space. The space has a green wave to represent fields and a blue wave to represent streams and rivers. There is also a sun rising in the distance to represent the county's Native American heritage. The county is named after Chief Black Hawk, a warrior and leader for the Sauk people. DeWitt, along with the graphic design company Corkery & Corkery, highlighted the logo's modern look compared to its predecessor. It represents progress and inclusivity, appealing to all members of the community regardless of background, and represents cultural diversity and unity among hardworking people who live, work, and play in Black Hawk County, she said. County officials allocated $12,500 for the contract with Corkery and Corkery. They also spent another $9,000 for signage and swag such as t-shirts, pens, notebooks, and stickers. The logo will eventually be on all county cars except for the Sheriff's Department, which has to abide by state standards. That is expected to be rolled out next year, and there is no estimated cost for the new decals. Iowa Tourism awarded Grow Cedar Valley with the People's Choice Award for its Live the Valley selfie mural. The project was a collaboration between Grow Cedar Valley and My Waterloo Days. Festival attendees engaged with the selfie stations and watched internationally renowned artist Paco creating a mural that showcased the city, Cedar Valley's diversity and vibrancy. Stacy Hub Ballard, Iowa Economic Development Authority's Chief Strategic Communications Officer, said the project highlighted the area. Iowa needs more people to fill our great jobs, and the state is well positioned to reap the benefits of intentional talent attraction efforts, such as Live the Valley, she said in a press release. The Cedar Valley and other regions have what top talent are looking for, from beautiful landscapes and vibrant cities to unmatched quality of life, including friendly communities and a low cost of living. Nicole Salas, Cedar Valley's Director of Marketing and Communication, was the driving force behind the mural. Family and Friends Council is asking everyone to wear blue on Friday in recognition of Child Abuse Prevention Awareness Month. The organization is the area's only child abuse prevention agency with a mission to make sure every child is happy, healthy, and safe. Their programs are designed to prevent child abuse and strengthen families. They are in preschool through sixth grade classrooms with their Take Care of Your Body program that teaches children about appropriate touches. Executive Director Amanda Goodman said 90% of child sex abuse victims know and trust their predators. Black Hawk County continues to rank as one of the highest in the state when it comes to reported child abuse cases, she said in a press release. We're reaching epidemic levels, and it's because I believe that everyone wants to protect a child unless it affects an adult they know. The organization is also encouraging everyone to tie blue ribbons at their homes and businesses to show children that they matter. Award-winning big tree hunter Mark Rowe will present Iowa's largest and tallest trees at the 7 p.m. Tuesday meeting of the Prairie Rapids Audubon Society. The event takes place at the First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Falls. The public may attend. The event may also be viewed via live stream by a live Zoom. For the link and more information, go to gopras.org. The Waldemar A. Schmidt Gallery at Wartburg College will offer a new exhibition featuring work by Wartburg seniors. An opening reception from 7 to 8:30 p.m. on April 11th and will include remarks from the artists and light refreshments. The student artists, all senior graphic design majors in the fine arts program, have been enrolled in the spring senior seminar session. Working under the direction of Barbara Fettler, they have produced bodies of work representing the culmination of their careers at Wartburg. The works incorporate design, photography, music, electronic media, art installations, and other elements. The exhibition will remain on view in the Waldemar A. Schmidt Gallery through May 26th. The featured artists are Aaron Boucher Donati, Katie Haverlow, Sam Lockhart, Lily Meester, Milagros Toribio Porras, J.C. Werning, and Britta Williams. The Waldemar A. Schmidt Gallery is in the Bachman Fine Arts Center. Hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. daily. The gallery is open to the public and admission is free. Visitors may park without charge in the nearby F lot. Black Hawk County Conservation staff will host Daryl Smith, Emeritus Professor of Biology and the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa for the next Second Sunday Speaker event, April 14th. Daryl will present Nurturing Iowa Prairie at 2 p.m. in the community room at Hartman Reserve. Smith has played an integral part in prairie preservation, management, and restoration in our state, including his leadership in the development of a statewide program of utilizing native vegetation in Iowa's roadsides. In 2019, UNI Tallgrass Prairie that he planted in 1973 was dedicated and renamed the Daryl Smith Prairie to honor his 50-plus years of dedication to prairie education and preservation. Daryl co-authored the Tallgrass Prairie Center Guide to Prairie Restoration in the Upper Midwest, a comprehensive manual and essential companion for everyone interested in planning, developing, and maintaining all types of prairie restorations and reconstructions. His presentation at Hartman will include an introduction to past Iowa prairie and then move into retaining an aspect of Iowa prairie by establishing and maintaining prairie patches and yards. On Monday, the moon will pass between the sun and the earth. Millions of Americans across 15 states will experience totality during the solar eclipse, when the moon completely covers the sun. According to NASA, the eclipse's path of totality enters the United States in Texas and will travel through Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, as well as slivers of Tennessee and Michigan. Iowans will experience a partial solar eclipse. The experience of seeing a total solar eclipse, even a partial eclipse, is unusual. We think of the sun as this friendly yellow sun-made raisin box disk that rises in the morning and sets in the evening. When it goes completely dark in the middle of the day, the metamorphosis is both wonderful and shocking, said Tom Hockey, astronomy professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Hockey won't be here for the partial eclipse. Instead, he is leading a group of UNI students into the path of totality in northern Indiana. With fingers crossed for a clear, sunny blue sky, the day trippers will watch as the moon obscures the sun and makes the sun's atmosphere, the corona, easier to see. NASA says the sun's diameter is about 400 times larger than the moon's, and the sun is almost 400 times farther away from us than the moon is. This combination makes the sun and moon appear nearly the same size in our sky, setting up a spectacular show when they are aligned. Hockey is excited. A total solar eclipse hits you at gut level. You see the outer layers of the sun, strange and colorful shapes unlike anything anyone has ever seen before. The quality of light eerily changes just before totality, he enthused. Scientists expect structure and streamers to be more noticeable during this eclipse because the sun is more active, with sunspots and other sun surface activity. This is the second total solar eclipse in the past 7 years. That's amazing and unusual to have two eclipses happen so close together, Hockey noted. In 2017, totality lasted 2 minutes and 42 seconds. Totality will last longer during Monday's eclipse, according to astronomers, because the moon is closer to the Earth and the shadow on the sun will be wider. One nugget periodically popping up on the internet notes that Bonnie Tyler's song Total Eclipse of the Heart runs 4 minutes and 30 seconds, which is a bit longer than Monday's totality, expected to last 4 minutes and 27 seconds. Hockey is a self-described eclipse chaser. It goes all the way back to when I was 10 years old and watched a partial solar eclipse in my front yard in Indiana. I didn't see a total solar eclipse until 1991 when I read one would be visible in the U.S. from Hawaii. What's the worst that could happen? I could get clouded out, but I'd be in Hawaii. There didn't seem to be a downside, so I went, he explained. He was hooked. I don't care where I have to go to see one, Hockey confessed. He's traveled to Chile, Paraguay, Argentina, Mongolia, Romania, Turkey, and Missouri for the chance of following another total solar eclipse. Being an eclipse chaser is a wonderful excuse to travel to parts of the world you wouldn't ordinarily think of if you weren't drawn by an eclipse. Of course, the sun and moon don't make your travel plans, and it may be cloudy, but it's still fun to go. Hockey, who teaches the history of astronomy, is author of the recently published book America's First Eclipse Chasers, Stories of Science, Planet Vulcan, Quicksand, and the Railroad Boom. It's not a cover-to-cover read. You can pick up and choose what you want to read. You can read the opening chapters or skip to the actual events, Hockey said. In simple terms, he describes astronomical tools of the trade at the time and how they work or didn't, and tells chaotic stories about the first eclipse chasers. He writes with wit and humor about the 1869 total solar eclipse, in particular that fell in the Midwest, particularly over Iowa. It was the first time in the United States that astronomers and tourists in large numbers made organized pilgrimages to see this awesome preternatural pageant in the sky, Hockey writes. The 1869 Path of Totality tracked over the house where Hockey now lives in Cedar Falls. The track made a nearly perfect diagonal across Iowa, and here it was to be at its widest compared to other states. This assured that proportionately more people in this state were under the shadow of the moon than in any other. Iowa, too, was the prime target for most 1869 solar eclipse wayfarers, he wrote, including famous astronomers like Simon Newcomb and Maria Mitchell. Some places in Iowa can be found where astronomers set up their equipment to measure the eclipse. The spot in Des Moines is now underneath an interstate ramp, and other places simply no longer exist. The book idea percolated for many years, Hockey admitted. The genesis of it was whining. As a professor of the history of astronomy, I whined that the Midwest was at a disadvantage for total eclipses, which seemed to take place on the west or east coasts. The 2017 eclipse was the spark that got me going. Safe viewing of a solar eclipse requires protective eye gear. Staring at the sun with the naked eye can cause eye damage or permanent vision loss. Sunglasses aren't enough, Hockey pointed out. Even a brief look at a partial eclipse can cause damage. Wear only glasses specifically designed for solar eclipse events. Looking at the eclipse through an unfiltered camera, even the one on your cell phone, will not protect your eyes from damage, even with eye protection, NASA cautions. Optical devices concentrate solar rays that damage the eyes. Hockey said it's okay to look at the sun with the naked eye during those few minutes of totally when the sun is completely blotted out. But as soon as the sun begins to reemerge, remember to immediately put back on your eye protection. America's first eclipse chasers, stories of science, planet Vulcan, quicksand, and the railroad boom, published by Springer in association with Praxis Publishing, is available from online booksellers. And if you're interested, you can join your friends at the Norris Corson Family Planetarium from noon to 3 p.m. to view NASA's live stream of the solar eclipse on Monday. Cost is $10 per person. Seating is limited and pre-registration is required at groutmuseumdistrict.org. The line of totality, where the sun is completely covered, will span 15 states, but a partial eclipse will appear in all continental U.S. states, including Iowa. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.